So what can you do? What can you do realistically, you know, that takes into account what you are about? Well, here is what you can do. Ignore the activists, ignore the revolutionaries. We have to face bullets, we have to face military trials. It doesn't matter really what you do. It doesn't matter if Facebook is going to reveal my information or not. I have to assume that I'm being constantly watched, that I'm being that everything about me is public. It doesn't matter. But what matters is ordinary users who use your products to practice their agency. When you decide that they cannot decide to choose a pseudonym, then you are negating them the right to negotiate their identity. The right to negotiate your identity is, it's not in the Charter of Human Rights, but it's actually essential to most rights. Negotiated identity is very important. I get to choose whether to reveal who I am and how to reveal who I am and decide who I am on my own terms and on my own basis.
The birth of a brave new world. Two. Atoms and bits. Advocates of the fourth technological revolution, narrative, insist on drawing dubious parallels with the industrial revolution. And yet they claim that modern technologies like the sharing economy, artificial intelligence, deep learning, 3D printing, etc. are primarily concerned with informational space rather than material space, thus implying that this technological revolution is geographically neutral and downplaying the severity of its collateral violence. The implication being a stark contrast with the Industrial Revolution, which provoked fierce competition over raw materials, energy sources, and global trade routes. Certainly, the prospect of the sharing economy giving rise to a world war is unlikely. But that's not to say that it doesn't involve any violence or repression, because this idea of a clear separation from the material world is a myth. Uber could never have flourished were smartphones not already widely available. Smartphones are produced in large numbers at relatively low cost with a substantial profit margin for Apple and the like. The model relies on enormous Chinese factories where workers suffer appalling working conditions. Sometimes laborers are detained at their workstations in what basically amounts to forced labor. Apple has faced repeated scandals over working conditions, most notably the high suicide rate among workers. Those factories also rely on rare minerals, which are extracted in primitive mines in Africa, where child labor is rife. Health and environmental conditions are dire, and profits fuel vicious conflicts between militias and armed gangs. Even in the United States, potential violence is not absent from the equation. With the development of its economy, primary manufacture has largely given way to the production and consumption of software, design, and services. And despite the drop in unemployment rates, many attribute the rise of the far right, Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and their ilk, to the fragile position of the working class in this new flexible labor market. A new aggressive discourse has surfaced, with mass mobilizations and calls for solutions from the past as a reaction to the political, economic, media, and academic elites' insistence that labor rights and protections need to be rolled back. But more dangerous than the flawed parallels between the Industrial Revolution and its alleged technological counterpart is the assumption that the unequal distribution of benefit from adopting new technologies is down to resource distribution. The accumulation of capital gains was never purely a result of technology and markets, but first and foremost of state policies. Brazil, for example, accumulated social institutions and services as it invested the profits from exporting raw materials into health and education, while the DR, Democratic Republic Congo, only accumulated weapons and militias. China accumulated infrastructure and scientific and engineering expertise from the profits of its manufactured exports, while Bangladesh accumulated the corpses of impoverished workers in crumbling factories. In fact, by comparison with the Industrial Revolution, the intangible nature of the technological revolution might mean that fewer gains are created overall, but that accumulation is more concentrated. The Industrial Revolution transformed the production process itself. Then the nature of the goods produced and changes in the labor market happened as a result. But the sharing economy offers no new means of producing goods or services. The scope of its transformation is the labor market itself, not what the labor does. Uber, for example, has not altered transportation technology. Uber's answer to the question, how will I get from home to work, is the same answer offered by a taxi, that you'll hire a car and a driver for a single journey at a price proportional to the time and distance. What has changed is the mechanism of contracting a driver, the distribution of profit earned, and the ownership structure of the service. The sharing economy model depends fundamentally on the fact that the cost of the service to new users, the cost of downloading an app and creating an account, is tiny. While the cost of entering new markets is low, so it is unlikely that any new accumulation of capital, assets, infrastructure, expertise, knowledge, or services will take place. Uber Egypt's office is probably small. The number of employees actually needed to manage the market is small, and the nature of their work will not result in any knowledge transfer. And of course, the company will not own or develop assets or equipment and will not invest in infrastructure. The driver provides the car and the state provides the roads and the dollar subsidized fuel. And when the company makes profits in Egyptian pounds, it will transfer them out of the country in dollars. So the only accumulation is happening in California. The profits are there, as are the investments and top jobs, management, design, programming, planning, etc. And since Uber defines itself as a software company rather than a transport company, don't expect it to pay significant taxes, neither here nor there. Most major Silicon Valley companies register their headquarters in tax havens and claim that they make most of their profits in those headquarters to benefit from double taxation prevention agreements. The US has serious difficulties in recovering taxes from the world's richest corporations like Google, Apple, and Facebook, so much so that Obama became personally involved in negotiations with each of these companies and still came away with little more than crumbs. As for Egypt's track record in benefiting from the fruits of the Industrial Revolution, that's a sorry tale. Despite our early integration into its markets, the current dollar crisis being a case in point, and our track record in collecting taxes is so better, just listen to the stories about the state's inability to collect income tax from some of its own employees, because they happen to be judges. There is no reason to assume we will perform any better in the present technological revolution. The only proven fact is that Uber offers a better service to the consumer. Anything else is just rosy dreams and fairy tales and maybe some good intentions. But good intentions, as our inspired president famously said, do not build a state. Written in Torah prison, published on June 17, 2016, in Madam Asser. Statement to the prosecutor. This is my last hearing in front of the prosecution, and for several hearings now I've been requesting that the investigation be completed along with other requests and complaints about my detention conditions and the situation regarding my son. First, on the detention conditions, and here I'm presenting a complaint for the ninth time to the prosecution. My lawyers have filed complaints with state security prosecution, and my family have presented complaints directly to the Prosecutor General at his Office of Human Rights Affairs. As for the charges I'm facing, my situation has become absurd, beyond even a novelist's imagination. Over the course of 10 hearings to renew my detention, the prosecution has not confronted me with details of the investigation, or any evidence or witness testimonies, or even explanatory details of the charges against me. So I have ended up guessing the political reasons for my detention and acknowledging them. I don't know whether the prosecution is reluctant to pursue the investigation or incapable of dismissing it. It seems that the decision about whether or not to release me lies beyond this building. This is unfortunately a systematic practice affecting hundreds, even thousands, to circumvent the Constitutional Court's ruling on the unconstitutionality of administrative detention. So cases just stay open for years without referral to court. Practically, I am a captive, not a defendant. Tora Prison Complex is a detention camp, not a prison. And we are captives of a system that was dedicated to protecting the authority of a person or a regime, but now has become a burden on the regime itself. Actually, the state institutions have become dedicated to protecting and covering up for repression, and repression has become an end in itself, which severely threatens the future of this nation. Nevertheless, I will not tire of addressing the prosecution seriously, filing complaints, appeals, and reports, and complying with the investigation procedures. Because one decision to dismiss a case or drop charges or a serious inspection of a prison or investigation of a violation or disappearance, even by one investigator, may present a lifeline for a nation that has been deprived of justice for too long. Finally, I would like to thank the prosecution for their patience and for their human treatment and handling of my ordeal and that of my son, and for allowing Khaled to visit me here at the prosecution headquarters. The look of human compassion I see in their faces when Khaled has come to this building has been a glimmer of hope. I take pride in every word I have put on record during these 10 sessions. I pray that God may accept them in the balance of my good deeds, and that the people may count them in the measure of my struggle. Delivered on 5 February 2020. On BDS. The attack on BDS is so absurd that taking a position against it requires stating the obvious as a form of action. One thing that should be examined, though, is how this current wave of attacks isn't solely about Hasbara and deep-rooted German guilt, but also about a form of xenophobia that masquerades as a disciplinarian form of liberalism. BDS is an act of solidarity with the Palestinians. Resisting the anti-BDS campaign is about issues that affect all democracies. Published on 24 September 2019 on Facebook. Hasbara is the Hebrew word for explanation, which is also understood as meaning propaganda. A handwritten note. Hi, I've not seen your letter yet, so I can't respond. And I don't know which one of you is here, but I think it's Mama. I'm a bit worried at the thought of you waiting out there in this rain. It looks like the whole place has drowned, as usual. But honestly, when it was raining, it was joyful, and the smell of the wet dust was good, and the sound of people raising prayers was inspiring. You miss being part of nature and the climate, but this rain is making itself felt through the walls. I hope you're all well. My health is good. That's all I can say. The day of my birthday was a bit dramatic, and I couldn't celebrate, but the banana cake made up for things a bit. I try to energize my head in the absence of books by remembering stories from history, sometimes by chattering on about science. My imagination can't really engage with post-release dreams, but, you know, one tries to find reason for optimism in the ebbing of the right-wing wave in the world and to believe its effects will reach us. Of course, I'm used to Gramsci's method regarding the pessimism of the mind and the optimism of the will. But there's such negation of the will here that I need to train myself into an optimism of the mind before I mess up my colleagues. That's all. I'm generally fine, and I love you and miss you. November 2020.
We are calling for the immediate release of Alaa Abd El Fattah. Join us on freealaa.net to find out how you can help.